You know, brothers and sisters, it's a very profound thought that Jesus is alive, that he lives forever, that he's at the right hand of God, and that he makes intercession for us. He intervenes, he intercedes for us. And that he's able to save to the uttermost. Hebrews chapter 7 says, he is always able to save those who come to God through him, since he always lives to intercede for them. And he knows us. He's trod the path before us. And he's learned obedience by what he himself has suffered, to the extent that he's borne our sicknesses, he's carried our griefs. Now, we've just finished reading Exodus, and in the book of Exodus there is the example of Moses as intercessor. And I think our understanding of what intercession is enriched by what we learn of Moses. A brief summary of Exodus from chapter 12, where we have the Passover, through to the setting up of the tabernacle at the end of the book. It all happens within 1 year. The tabernacle itself, the constructing of all of the furniture and the outer tabernacle itself, was all done in the second part of that year. In the first part of the year, the rest of the events of Exodus happened. We know from the reading from 1 Corinthians 10 that we shared together that there are patterns, aren't there, in the scriptures, and it seems to be God's method of having us consider and learn from the examples of what have gone before, and they in turn provide types of what will follow. Now, I want to go in at chapter 24 of Exodus, which is the occasion, as I follow it through, of the sixth ascent of Moses to the top of Mount Sinai. On this occasion, he's accompanied by Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of Israel's elders. And they come with him, obviously, so far up the mountain. Verse 12, the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and stay there, so that I may give you the stone tablets with the law and commandments I have written for their instruction. So Moses arose with his assistant Joshua and went up the mountain of God. He told the elders, wait here for us until we return to you. Aaron and Hur are here with you. Whoever has a dispute should go to them. When Moses went up the mountain, the cloud covered it. The glory of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. On the seventh day, he called to Moses from the cloud. The sight of the Lord's glory to the Israelites was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop. Moses entered the cloud as he went up the mountain, and he remained on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. Now, reflecting on that, Aaron and Hur, possibly Hur, were charged with standing in as deputies to act for Moses. And they watched him as he went up the mountain, the cloud receiving them, him out of their sight. Which has overtones, doesn't it, of the Lord's resurrection, the Lord's ascension. And in that 40 days, Moses was given the full details of the tabernacle that was to be built. At the end of that time, he was ready to return. And at the end of chapter 31, when he finished speaking with Moses on Mount Sinai, God gave him the two tablets of the testimony, stone tablets inscribed with the finger of God. Now, at the same time as that happened, beneath Mount Sinai, in the camp, right at the end of the 40 days, there were stirrings, and 2 million people challenged Aaron. When the people saw that Moses delayed in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us a god who will go before us, because this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him." Moses is still on the mountain. And God spoke to Moses, "Go down at once," verse 7 of chapter 32, "for your people you brought up from the land of Egypt have become corrupt. They have quickly turned from the way I commanded them. They've made for themselves an image of a calf. They've bowed down to it, sacrificed to it, and said, 'Israel, this is your God who brought you up from the land of Egypt.'" And the Lord said to Moses, "I have seen this people. They are indeed a stiff-necked people. Now, leave me alone so that my anger can burn against them and I can destroy them. Then I'll make you into a great nation." And the language that God uses in verse 10 is intensive, and it is an imperative command. It's the imperative form of the verb. It's an instruction, it's an order. "Leave me alone so that my anger can burn against them." To the second generation, 40 years later, Moses recalls this occasion. Now look at Deuteronomy 9, verse 8. "You provoked the Lord at Horeb," says Moses to the people, "and he was angry enough with you to destroy you. When I went up the mountain to receive the stone tablets, tablets of the covenant the Lord made for you, I stayed on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. I did not eat bread or drink water." You know, 3 days without water and 3 weeks without food is enough to finish a life. And Moses was 40 days and 40 nights without either. From which the Lord Jesus, and Moses in Deuteronomy 8 of course, says that man does not live on bread alone. And both Moses and the Lord, in his wilderness temptations, testify to the truth of that. Israel, of course, have had the manna, quails, and they've been provided with water miraculously. And they knew the truth of that. But Moses became the living truth of it as he went without water, without food, for 40 days and 40 nights. And then Moses, without food and water, in verse 11, interceded with the Lord his God. Lord, why does your anger burn against your people you brought up out of the land of Egypt? You see the way he turns it round? God had described them as his people, Moses' people. Moses turns it round, they're your people. Why should the Egyptians say, he brought them out with an evil intent to kill them in the mountains and wipe them off the face of the earth? Turn from your great anger. And my version says, change your mind about this disaster. And in the Hebrew, change your mind is passive. Have your mind changed. And what Moses is referring to, I believe, is the intercession that he is making to have God's mind changed about this disaster for your people. Verse 12. The language of Moses, I think, is not one who is distraught or at his wit's end or who is desperate. It's the language of one who knew the people, who knew their weaknesses, and who was doing his utmost to save them. He also knew the promises of God. Because what he's saying is, turn your great anger and have your mind changed about this disaster. He'd been on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. One disaster that had 40 days and 40 nights in it, of course, was the flood. If you do this, it's another complete wipeout, like the flood. Or Babel, perhaps. Remember that you swore to your servants Abraham, Isaac and Israel by yourself and declared to them, I will make your offspring as numerous as the stars of the sky, will give your offspring all this land that I've promised. And here's the effectiveness of the intercession of the man Moses. So the Lord's mind was changed about the disaster he said he would bring on his people. So Moses has corrected as to who the people are. They are God's people. When he said the Lord's mind was changed, and when he asked for God's mind to be changed, he also used the imperative form of that verb. And as for God changing his mind, if you have a look at Jeremiah 18, words from the Lord of Jeremiah, verse 8. If that nation I have made an announcement about turns from its evil, I will not bring the disaster on it I have planned. Psalm 106 that we read together recalls the incident that we're looking at. Verse 19, at Horeb they made a calf, and they worshipped the cast metal image. They exchanged their glory, the glory of God, and the position that he has brought them to, the salvation that he delivered them, they exchanged for the image of a grass-eating ox. They forgot God, their Saviour, who did great things in Egypt. So he said he would have destroyed them if Moses, his chosen one, had not stood before him in the breach to turn his wrath away from destroying them. So it's perhaps with relief in verse 15 that Moses turned and went down the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, inscribed on both sides, front and back. The tablets were the work of God. The writing was God's writing, engraved on the tablets. Why else would God have given him those to take back if he was going to bring the disaster? Disaster had been averted for the time being, because their rescue, their salvation that they were so far along the track of receiving almost didn't happen. Were it not for the intercessions of Moses, there would have been no tabernacle, no dwelling of God among them. Their journey through the wilderness to the promised land and the kingdom would have been abandoned, and there would have been no salvation for you and for I. And it's as if reality, the reality of what is happening below, at the foot of the mount, only his home, when Moses saw with the sight of his own eyes, as he approached the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, Moses became enraged and threw the tablets out of his hand, smashing them at the base of the mountain. He took the calf they had made, he burned it up, ground it to powder, scattered the powder over the water, surface of the water, and forced the Israelites to drink of the water. And with that calf, Moses couldn't have done a more complete job of obliterating and getting rid of it than what he did. And he made them drink of their sin. Moses refers to the height of the crisis 40 years later in Deuteronomy chapter 9. Now looking at verse 19, I was afraid of the fierce anger the Lord had directed against you, because he was about to destroy you. But again, the Lord listened to me on that occasion. The Lord was angry enough with Aaron to destroy him, but I prayed for Aaron at that time also. You see, in the pattern, what had happened after Moses' ascension, after they watched him go, enveloped by the cloud. So much can go wrong when the Lord is absent. Moses saw that the people were out of control, verse 25 of Exodus 32, for Aaron had let them get out of control so that they would be a derision to their enemies. The following day, verse 30, Moses said to the people, "You have committed a great sin. Now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I will be able to atone for your sin." So Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Oh, this people has committed a great sin. They've made for themselves a god of gold. Now if you would only forgive their sin. If not, please erase me from the book you have written." So if Moses is offering himself as a sacrifice, but of course that is not acceptable. The Lord replied to Moses, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will erase from my book. Now go, lead the people to the place I've told you about." There follows God's instruction. Go, leave here, you and the people you brought up from the land of Egypt, to the land I promised Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, saying, "I will give it to your offspring. I will send an angel before your face and will drive out Canaanites, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites and so on. Go to a land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go with you because you are a stiff-necked people. Otherwise, I might destroy you in the way. Tell the Israelites, you are a stiff-necked people. If I went with you for a single moment, I would destroy you." So Moses' efforts at reconciliation had not achieved the desired resolution. And it seems that Moses is holding firm. As long as this remains the case, he's going nowhere. Despite the instruction to go, leave here, take the people. Verse 7 of chapter 33, "Now Moses took a tent." Remember, the tabernacle has not started to be constructed yet. "Now Moses took a tent and set it up outside the camp, far away from the camp. He called it the tent of meeting. Anyone who wanted to consult the Lord would go to the tent of meeting that was outside the camp. Whenever Moses went out to the tent, all the people would stand up, each one at the door of his tent. They would watch Moses until he entered. When Moses entered the tent, the pillar of cloud would come down and remain at the entrance to the tent, and the Lord would speak with Moses. As all the people saw the pillar of cloud remaining at the entrance to the tent, they would stand up, bow in worship, each one at the door of his tent." Something has gone home, hasn't it, to the people? The Lord spoke with Moses face to face, just as a man speaks with his friend. And then Moses says, "Look, Lord, you have told me, lead this people up, but you've not let me know who you will send with me. You said, I know you by name. You also found favor in my sight. Now, if I have indeed found favor in your sight, please teach me your ways and I'll know you and find favor in your sight. Now, consider that this nation is your people." God replied, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. And Moses comes back. If your presence does not go, don't make us go up from here. How will it be known that I and thy people have found favor in thy sight unless thou go with us? I and your people will be distinguished by this from all the other people on the face of the earth. Moses knows that if he goes forward without this resolution, there will only be disaster. It won't be long. There'll be no food. There'll be no water. There'll be enemies. There'll be opponents within, opponents without. And we have to note those pronouns and the persistence of Moses. His refusal to be separated from the people that he has come to save. I and your people will be distinguished from all other people on the face of the earth by this, otherwise we're no different. And there's not an ounce of arrogance from this, the humblest man that walked the earth. And how close to the Lord he's become and is treading now. And the Lord answered Moses, I will do this very thing you have asked, for thou hast found favor in my sight, and I know you by name. And in the crisis of the situation, perhaps, Moses asks, please, show me your glory. And God promises that he will make all his goodness to pass before him, to proclaim his name. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious. I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. And yet perhaps still is the thought, okay, you're speaking to me and assuring me of those things. What about these people? These sheep? And the Lord said, here is a place with me. You're to stand on the rock. When my glory passes by, I'll put you in the crevice, cover you with my hand until I've passed by. Then I'll take my hand away and you'll see my back, but my face will not be seen. To me, that seems such a clumsy translation when the word carries with it the aftermath. When God's glory has been shown to Moses and he conceals him in the hollow of his hand, the hand that nurtures and protects, Moses will see the aftermath of God as he passes by. One last time, Moses climbed the mountain with the two fresh tablets to replace the ones he had smashed. And I suspect that it's now that Moses has this vision of glory on this occasion that God had promised him in chapter 33. And verse 6, then the Lord passed in front of him and proclaimed, Yahweh. Yahweh is a compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger and rich in faithful love and truth. This is the context of it. Maintaining faithful love to a thousand generations, forgiving wrongdoing, rebellion, and sin. And in that statement of the Almighty, we have the three words for sin that David mentions in Psalm 32. And no doubt David was recalling this same revelation to Moses when he says, "How happy is the one whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. How happy is the man the Lord does not charge with sin, in whose spirit is no deceit." And those three words that cover all sin are there. Pesha, transgression, revolt, rebellion. Katar, missing one step, stumbling and falling. And Aaron, to be bent, to be crooked. And they sum up our situation, don't they? It's how we're born, altogether born in sin. We're bent, we're crooked. At times we revolt, we rebel, and we're forever missing our step. And God can forgive all that. But he will not leave unpunished, bringing the consequences of the father's wrongdoing on the children and grandchildren of the third and fourth generation. And so Moses immediately bowed down to the ground and worshipped, and he said, "My Lord, Adonai, if I have indeed found favour in your sight, Adonai, please go in the midst of us." That's full of meaning, isn't it? All around might be enemies, but please, you be in the midst of us, even though this is a stiff-necked people. Forgive our wrongdoing, our sin, and accept us as your own possession. And God promises, "I will perform wonders in the presence of all your people that have never been," and the word is created, "never been created in all the earth or in any of the nations. All the people you live among will see the Lord's work. For what I am doing with you is awe-inspiring." And so Moses knows that his people have a future. Within a day or so, Moses said to the Israelite community, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Take up an offering among you for the Lord. Let everyone whose heart is willing bring this to the Lord's offering." And we know what they were to bring. They were to bring of their substance, to bring of their talents, to bring of their skills. And Bezalel and Aholiab, with the Spirit of God, lead the work. And Moses hasn't just delegated. Chapter 36, Moses summoned Bezalel and Aholiab and every skilled person in whose heart the Lord had placed wisdom. Everyone whose heart moved him to come to the work and do it. They took from Moses' presence all the contributions that the Israelites had brought for the task of making the sanctuary. So, the future of Israel is still on. And 6 months later, we read in chapter 39, "So all the work for the tabernacle was finished. The Israelites did everything just as the Lord had commanded Moses. The Israelites had done all the work according to everything the Lord had commanded by Moses. Moses inspected all the work they'd accomplished. They had done just as the Lord commanded." And so Exodus ends on a high note. at this point, at least for the time being, God's people seem to be back on track and with godly enthusiasm and commendation. I just want to close with what may or may not be a hint of this when Paul writes to the Corinthians in his second letter. Now look in chapter 8. We want you to know, brothers, about the grace, the favour of God granted to the churches of Macedonia. In my thought, the grace that he granted Israel during a severe testing by affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed into the wealth of their generosity. I testify that on their own, according to their ability and beyond their ability, they begged us insistently for the privilege of sharing in the ministry to the saints. And not just as we'd hoped, instead they gave themselves especially to the Lord, then to us by God's will. So we urge Titus that just as he had begun, so he should also complete this grace to you. Now, as you excel in everything, excel also in this grace. And in chapter 9 he says, and God is able to make every grace overflow to you, so that in every way, always having everything you need, you may excel in every good work. And that's what the intercessionary work of the Lord our Master has brought us to.